Earlier this week, I caught up with journalist and author Kieran Murphy, who at the spry young age of 41 decided it was time to travel all the way down to his father's hometown of Anshanfubble in West Waterford to pick up hurling for the first time, chronicling his experience in his brand new book, Old Parish.
Sports Beat Extra.
Beat 102-103.
Kieran, thanks a million for joining me. I mean, you've been on the road a lot now promoting this new book, Old Parish. I mean, for you, I suppose, going from, I suppose, an area you were very familiar with, Gaelic football, and focusing on the life of that back in Milltown and Galway and kind of moving over to Dublin, what was it like to approach a newer subject to you, one that you had maybe seen on TV and kind of covered as a journalist, but then actually to jump into it was, I suppose, as you will have covered in the book, mainly a lot, you know, a much more different experience.
Yeah. Well, I think, well, first of all, thanks for having me on, Adrian. I really appreciate it. I think my relationship with hurling is similar to a lot of people born in sort of the northern half of the country, which is that we feel this kind of pride about it, even though it's not something that we grew up with or even play. It's something that we're very proud to tell, you know, Americans sitting in a pub in Dublin, what the hell are we watching here? And, you know, you'd sort of give them the spiel about Cú Chulainn and 3,000 years of history and mythology and all of the rest of this. But we never got the chance to play it, you know. So my relationship with hurling has always been just unceasing kind of admiration for the people who play it, jealousy for the people who grew up with it kind of as part of their everyday life. And I think really, maybe a suggestion of exclusion, you know, that I was born in Galway, which is obviously one of, you know, maybe less than a dozen counties that take it seriously, but I was born in the wrong part of Galway for hurling. So there was no hurling within kind of 20 miles of my home club of Milltown. So there was kind of that feeling of exclusion, and that kind of always stayed with me. And then kind of the older I got, the more dabbling in a bit of sort of, you know, park hurling, as in like knocking the ball back and forth between myself and a couple of buddies, this curiosity kind of came, you know, like the idea that you'd stand on a GA pitch in the Phoenix Park with a goalpost at either end and not attempt to hit a few points. Like, you know, at some stage you're always going to try and, you know, see if you can channel your inner Joe Canning while standing still with no one watching you except your dog. And so, yeah, that kind of curiosity was always with me. And then to kind of take it to the next level, I suppose, is where sort of lunacy kicks in, and that's, you know, I'm happily blessed in that department obviously to do something like what I ended up doing in the book, which of course is taking up hurling at 41 in Old Parish in West Waterford. So yeah, I mean, that was my relationship with hurling, and my reasons for coming down here to do it is the fact that my dad is from Old Parish. I still have, you know, relations involved in Anshanfubble GA. So, like, that was the reason why I came down here. And for a variety of different reasons, I couldn't have picked a better place to go.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you speak on that, and I did want to pick up on that a little bit, because there's an element to the book that obviously talks about hurling in particular being the Irish sport and it being associated so much with Irish culture and the being of Irish. For you, obviously, coming down here, there's an element of going to the heartland of hurling, I suppose. If you're from Tipperary, you'll argue it's there.
Yeah.
But, you know, coming down here, was there that added element of you for your own, I suppose, on a smaller scale, a more personal being, of coming down to a place where obviously your father grew up and he played here, and kind of getting to know what he had such an affinity for about the area?
Oh, completely. So where I grew up was where my mam is from. So I was surrounded, like, from birth with my cousins on my mother's side. And so I just have, you know, just a really deep relationship with all of my cousins from around Milltown. And then you kind of come to Anshanfubble, where my dad was born. He left Anshanfubble in 1967 to work in Dublin's corporation. That's where he met my mam, and then moved to Galway then in the late 70s. So he hasn't lived in Anshanfubble for nearly 60 years. But then my uncle John still is, like, massively involved in the community in Anshanfubble. My Aunt Joan is Unrhyne. She was a Banachie in the Gaelscoil for years and years in Unrhyne. So I kind of came down here and I started seeing echoes of my dad in the places where he grew up and the people that he grew up with. And, you know, you get an insight into what kind of made your own father be the wonderful person that he is. And, like, that's not something that I expected on a conscious level, maybe, when I came down, but maybe in my subconscious I knew that's what I was looking for in a weird kind of way. So to kind of get that connection with my family down here and my extended family down here, it's like it's the key gift that I got from writing the book, without a shadow of it. I mean, the playing of hurling was great fun, and the book is funny about, or attempts to be funny about that, and attempts to see it all through the sort of slightly manic central thesis of the book, which is to start hurling at 41, which is obviously going to be played for laughs. But the key thing that I took from the writing of the book and subsequently talking about the book after its release actually is that, you know, that I got to know my dad much better, even though it was the summer I might have seen him least in my entire life, because I was down here and kind of trucking between Dublin for work and for parts of work, and then back down to Old Parish for my life down here for the 6 months that I was down here. That's I didn't expect that at all, but it was the biggest gift that I took out of the whole thing, I think.
Out of, obviously, you know, your last book, This Is the Life, and then this one, did your dad take a particularly bit greater interest in this one, considering obviously it was down here?
Yeah, well, he did and he didn't. You know, When I told him the idea, what I was going to do, I kind of expected him to be like, what are you doing? Like, oh, you know, opening up this, like, kind of Pandora's box of, oh, you know, just, like, getting involved in his life that he had, like, obviously not left behind, but he had, like, you know, he had moved away from in the mid-60s. But his reaction was just like, well, go on, like, you header if you want to, you know, like, you're 41, the time for me to stop you from doing crazy things has probably passed at this stage. And then after that, he was just, I think he loved the idea that I was meeting people that he had played football and hurling with in the 60s just on a regular basis, and getting to know people of his generation, not just you know, the players that I played with, who were, you know, to a man, incredibly welcoming. And I would have been playing with grandsons of the people that he would have been playing with, and sons and all the rest of that. But I think just the thrill was the fact that I was having such a brilliant time down here. I think that was the big thing for him. And once he saw that I was happy and that my wife was happy, and, you know, we were making a life down here effectively, I think he kind of couldn't care less after that. He would have loved, you know, a county championship would have been nice, a West Waterford final would have been nice, all of these things would have been nice, but you don't get everything in life, you know.
When you, I suppose, look at the experience of coming down here, and it can be quite a daunting task to come down to a completely new area, and obviously there is that familial connection,
yeah,
and even obviously your uncle being involved so heavily with the club, and when you go in, you're still kind of like, oh God, I am kind of going into a group of people who've known each other their entire lives, and yeah, kind of just inserting myself in, and it can feel like, I suppose, you're an outsider, to feel like a blow-in almost, as yeah, would be labelled. But for you, was it a weird sort of catch-22 where you are kind of a blow-in because you're coming from no history of the background, your own in your own personal life, but people already know who you are because not only your familial connection, but obviously your work as a journalist and as an author.
Yeah. Well, genuinely, that process lasted, I think, 5 minutes, you know, and I remember landing for my first hurling training session at the start of April 2024, and I was met by our team manager, Sean Wade, and he walked me around the clubhouse in on Shannafobel, and there's a couple of pictures up on the wall of, you know, West Waterford winning teams and junior football championship and intermediate football championship winning teams, and, you know, my dad is in these photographs, you know. So I don't know if he meant to do it on purpose or not, but, you know, you couldn't feel like a blow-in after, you know, if you get the tour and your dad is kind of up there on the wall. And then, almost to a man, every single one of my new teammates were coming over to shake my hand even before the first training session had started. And kind of from then on, genuinely, I never felt like I was imposing. I never felt like, I mean, I felt terrible about how useless I was at hurling, obviously. that feeling never went. But I never felt like an outsider. I was never made to feel like an outsider. And you kind of have to have a brass neck to do something like this, and I suppose I am gifted to a greater or lesser extent with a bit of a brass neck in that. And maybe I'd have been different if I came down at 24 or 25. I probably would have been filled with sort of those like sort of social warnings going off in my head. But I think kind of when you get to my age, you kind of just say, listen, I think people will see it for what I'm trying to do, which is to go in wholeheartedly to try and learn this sport. And Shannon Fubble is like a sufficiently small club for anybody to be useful. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like we have three adult teams or anything down there. We have one football team, one hurling team, and anyone who wants to contribute to either team is more than welcome. So I felt in that played to my advantage, at least, you know.
Do you think, obviously, as well, writing the book kind of made it impossible for you to even think about maybe I'll stop now after a few games?
Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, I was all in, you know. And yeah, in a weird way, I never thought about the possibility that after 3 weeks I just wouldn't fancy it. You know, I think if you'd asked me how I thought the year was going to go, I probably would have said that I'd be terrible for a couple of months, but eventually, you know, it's hurling. Like, how hard could it really be, you know, that I would end up being actually pretty decent? And anyone who's already read the book or is thinking about reading the book, I mean, it's not a spoiler to say that that is not how it panned out, that I found it difficult to start, and I continued to find it extremely difficult right up until the end. But yeah, I mean, you have to commit yourself to it totally. But even kind of beyond the book, I think if you go into any dressing room at the start of any year and you say that you're gonna try and contribute, then I think regardless of whether you're writing a book about it or not, there's a pressure there to finish the deal, for better or worse. So there was no fear of me backing out. I was having too much fun anyway, yeah, to be honest. So there was no fear.
I suppose, like a lot of your writing, and in particular, I suppose your books, this seems less of a sports book and more of a memoir, almost cultural look at Irishness in its entirety. And when you, I suppose, look at the element of obviously going down to immerse yourself in West Waterford and kind of taking in the community around it, the hurling almost plays a backseat, doesn't it?
Yeah. The book was always primarily, I suppose, going to be about the sort of humiliations and privations of taking on hurling, and that was kind of like the sort of the A storyline, you know. But running underneath all of that, you're absolutely right, is this idea that that, you know, you move to a Gaeltacht area and you throw yourself into the language as well. And like, my dad obviously grew up as a Gaelgor, has perfect Irish. My mother, which I actually only found out during the course of writing the book, actually, was like, she did her entire secondary schooling through Irish. Literally, like, the Eireachtas, Féile an Eireachtas was on in Belfast last weekend. And she told me that she had won an Eireachtas title in the Ogle of Birche, which is basically like debating or something, you know. And so I didn't have, so Mam and Dad would be able to speak Irish to each other all the time, and when they sit down to watch the games on TG Car every Sunday, it's just natural for them to keep talking in Irish during the game. Like, my brother edited On Colin Kuhn, which was obviously Oscar nominated film, completely Trí Gaeilge. So I should be a lot better at Irish than I am, and my Irish is nowhere near the level of my brother or my parents. But yeah, so I mean, I definitely did see it absolutely as being, you know, the reason why I play with Shannon Fubble is my dad, but also the idea that the Irish language and hurling are both kind of gatekept in kind of broadly similar ways. You know, that there is a certain cohort of people in the country that either speak Irish as their first language or in an everyday sense, or they grew up in hurling areas and they kind of own the thing and lease it out to the rest of us. You know, that, like, for better or worse, it's theirs. And if you're coming at it from the outside, as I am, both as a native English speaker and as a person who never played hurling, can be it can be exclusionary. It can feel exclusionary. But of course, I think that that's changed massively with the Irish language over the course of the last few years, whether that be through NECAP or through, you know, podcast Free Gaeilge, the How to Gael women obviously have like taken over the podcast space that I work in on a regular basis. So you kind of watch all of these developments, and it's just a brilliant thing to be a part of. I wish my Irish was good enough for me to feel like I was a part of that vanguard in the writing of this book. That's not what it is, but I do feel that there are similarities there that actually hurling people can probably try and learn from a little as well, in that if people's experience of Irish is only through school, and if people's only experience of hurling is, can we make you a brilliant hurler that will play for our club senior hurling team, then both of those things, they're too constrictive, you know. Whereas if you take Irish out of the classroom, and if you take hurling out of this idea that you have to be brilliant at it and you have to be aimed to be playing, you know, senior hurling for a really good club, if you take that pressure out of hurling and just experience hurling, as it turns out, I found out over the course of writing the book, that like the GA was born by Michael Cusack asking people, here, do you want to go to the Phoenix Park and puck around? You know, like I played hurling as a kid. Let's just do that for a while. That's like, you know, the January 1st, 1884. And that was like how I would have played hurling for the 20 years that I was in Dublin before I wrote this book, which is just me meeting up with friends and going like, none of us have ever played hurling. I've ever played a hurling game. But I like the feel of catching a sitter and poking it back and forth to friends, between friends. And I think that there's a lesson to be learned there for the GA, that if we kind of just stop thinking of it as something that is just like, how do we produce a really good hurler, and instead ask the question, let's just get people engaged with the game, let's just give them a chance to play in whatever, in if it's walking hurling or if it's just, you know, totally stationary hurling, whatever it is, let's just get people involved, however, and they can find their way to, you know, more organized games or, you know, top level club games or whatever, but let's just get hurlies in people's hands and see what happens. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a lesson, I think, that in my own head, I'm only, even since the book has been written, I've been kind of thinking more on that and realising actually there's a massive opportunity there if we kind of broaden our thinking in the GA about what it means to spread the gospel of hurling.
Mm. Yeah, I when you speak about the feeling of just even going out and pucking around and not even having that big experience in hurling, I think particularly to, I suppose, you're opening a few pages in the book when you mentioned about Declan Dalton's point for Cork in that Limerick game, which immediately when you started describing it, I was like, I've had that exact same moment myself, and I obviously there's countless other people that have seen that, where he's just produced this amazing level, well, there's been this amazing play of hurling in about 50 to 60 seconds, and you look at that and you may have no experience in hurling at all, but you come away with it with that tingling feeling of like, this is truly something amazing to be witnessing.
Yeah. There was like the first 90 seconds or 100 seconds of the Munster final, Clare and Limerick in 23, was it? Hmm. But it's kind of gone round Twitter like every 4 or 5 months. Just remember how insane the first, and it was just ridiculous. The moment you talk about it is like the 47th minute of the semi-final last year, and there's like, in 52 seconds, 7 turnovers, 3 goal chances. Just incredible. We've all lived through moments like that in hurling games, absolutely. You know, just where the whole thing just takes off. And there's no sport to beat hurling in that scenario. Like, you can talk to me about any kind of sport you like. You know, World Cup finals are incredible occasions. You know, Rugby World Cup quarterfinals are, you know, they're huge sort of civic moments in the life of the country, absolutely. But just, you know, for it to happen regularly, you know, that there could be 10 or 12 moments like that in any championship year, there's nothing to beat it. Like, I don't think there's anything to beat it out there, you know, nothing even comes close, really.
Is there something to be said for, I know we talk a lot about people's attention to sport now and actually getting through a full 90 minutes, and there was even talk about, I suppose, cricket is the big one that comes to mind for me, is that people will not sit and watch 5 days of the Ashes, but they'll be happily go out and watch a T20.
Yeah.
When you look at, like, say, the way hurling plays in comparison, even to Gaelic football, I think, like, my dad is not a huge, like, sports head, but he obviously, growing up in Sligo, he would watch Gaelic football, but he will admit till the day he dies, like, that hurling is more entertaining to watch,
yeah,
because of the pace and the speed of it. Do you think that we're in an area now that hurling is starting to come out into its own because people are maybe anxious to get a lot more in just a shorter space of time, whereas Gaelic football probably doesn't scratch that itch for them?
Yeah. It's an interesting point, actually. I think that your dad's experience is so true, that, you know, people get their backs up about, you know, sort of the hurling man and, you know, the hurling snob, mm-hmm. and all the rest. But, like, you know, if you actually talk to Gaelic football people and ask them, like, genuinely, what would you prefer to watch? It's like, well, a good hurling game beats anything, you know what I mean? But I mean, as to, like, the idea of the attention span, the shrinking attention span, I think what you saw with Gaelic football in the season just past, the intercounty season just past, and in the club games that I've watched kind of across the country, like, the game has gotten so much better that you're not looking at your phone, you know? And I think that, like, that's kind of the litmus test for any sporting occasion now. It's like, you know, can you go 10 minutes without looking at your phone while watching a sporting event? Like, I struggle with soccer, you know what I mean? I have to watch 10 soccer games a week probably for the day job with second captains. And I absolutely struggle with that. And I find myself looking at my phone and saying, I don't remember picking that up. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what it was in the game that just, like, led to me, like, oh, I'll just check Instagram or whatever, you know? Whereas it's the easiest thing in the world to watch hurling. And, I mean, I've been to that many hurling games. I don't ever remember taking a photograph at a hurling game, you know? Like, I'll go to the Aviva next Thursday, and I'm sure at some stage I'll be like, I should take a photograph of this, you know, I'm here with my brothers or whatever. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'll think that. Whereas during a hurling game, you don't think about anything other than what you're watching and how good it is. I think that's something that hurling obviously has over other sports. Like, other fans of other sports will, I'm sure, would tell me, well, you know, I'm more emotionally invested in that, in horse racing or whatever, and, like, that's fair enough. So I don't want to speak for everyone, but I like, that's my own personal experience, that, geez, I just, like, nothing, when it comes to that, can this sporting event hold you and grip you for an hour and 20 minutes or however long it takes? I mean, nothing comes close to hurling for me anyway.
When we talk about, I suppose to go back to that core point of the Irishness of hurling and kind of what it says about sort of the Irish identity, and you look at, I think back to last year's semi-finals and All-Ireland final, where obviously it was shown on BBC Sport, and you had, there was this big trend of, like, oh, here's what British people are reacting to hurling.
Yeah.
And it felt like, for me, that obviously it feels like hurling is a lot more niche in the sense of Irish sport, even though it is arguably probably, if you're going down to the crux of it, and for the more diehard fans, probably the more entertaining and more watched sport.
Yeah.
But Gaelic football feels like it's got that more mass appeal, obviously, because you've got teams like New York and London, and on top of that as well, it's like you mentioned, the economic benefit in playing Gaelic football as opposed to hurling. Like, do you feel that there's a draw to that now because we're in an element of, I suppose, Irish culture where people are really starting to go into what made Irish, like you mentioned, the language, the music, everything about that, and hurling feels like it's not being, suppose, commodified by the outside world.
I think that can cut two ways. I think, like, if you were, you know, sort of the American sitting in a pub watching Gaelic football, or someone in you know, Norfolk sitting down to watch BBC One on a July Sunday, and Gaelic football comes on, you'll be like, what the hell is this? And after kind of 3 minutes, you'll get an idea, okay, so a goal is under the bar, over the bar is a point. And then after that, the rules, like how the ball is transported from one to the other, you know, you can figure it out actually, you know, pretty quickly, I think. You know, whereas hurling, just by dint of the fact that, like, the danger element, I mean, you know, all of those tweet replies from Brits watching the hurling final is like, are these people completely insane? And I think that, like, as a result, it's harder maybe for people to understand, like, the level of skill required, the level of bravery required, but that's also kind of like, that is also thrilling to watch even though you don't understand it. So I don't know that it's necessarily you know, more or less sort of commodifiable, if that's the word, to the broader public. But I do think your point about the embrace of Irish culture and kind of sticking our chest out about the Irish language and Irish culture more generally, that's happened over the course of the last 10 or 15 years for a variety of reasons. I think that's absolutely something that hurling can cash in on, you know. And so I would have seen NECAP publicising the fact that there has been a 227% increase in the demand for Irish classes in Queen's University, you know. If you're the GAA or if you're William Maher, the new National Director of Hurling, are you looking at that going, in one way that's got nothing to do with me, and in another way that might have something massive to do with me? I mean, I think you can absolutely, the question of drawing a direct link between the explosion in the interest in Irish culture and Irish language, like hurling is that in a sporting realm. You know, Gaelic football is played in every village in the country. It's not like there needs to be an explosion of interest in Gaelic football. Gaelic football is at near enough saturation point in a lot of ways. So I don't think that there's something that you can, a massive untapped resource there, if you know what I mean. Whereas with hurling, I mean, yeah, like, of course, there's so many of us that just didn't get a chance to play it, and don't get a chance to engage with it, beyond that kind of vague sense of pride that we all feel in it. So in one way, it's a miracle that the GAA spread to every corner of the country with one sport. So the idea that you would then say, right, let's double down and let's get two sports played in every village in the country, going up against and competing with professional sports that have a footprint in this country, like rugby and soccer, like that's an insane thing to aim for. In another way, if you were looking at ways to grow a sport like hurling, there's no better chance to do it than with the existing infrastructure that we have, which is the club is already set up, the pitches are already there, the idea of representing your home place is already there. Like, all you're doing is kind of grafting it onto the Gaelic football club that you have. So in one way, it seems insane that you would aim for it to be played in as many places as Gaelic football is played. But in another way, it's like no other sport has even a remote chance. Has even remote as big a chance as hurling has to grow in all those places. If only because the GA is there already. It's just a case of adding one more GA sport to all this infrastructure that we already have.
Do you think that, I suppose, every county should be mandated to be dual?
I do, basically. Yeah. I kind of obviously it's an incredibly complicated question. Massively complex, but in another way it's kind of simple, you know, in that if you're a GAA club, you should probably offer both of the GAA sports, you know, both of the main GAA sports. You should offer them to under 7s, under 9s, under 11s, and if there's enough interest there, you should provide a team, and if there isn't enough interest in your club, you should amalgamate with a couple of other clubs to ensure that the kids that want to play are allowed to do it, you know. And like, I hear it a lot with the split season, you know, that that Galway people and Cork people will absolutely defend the split season to a hilt, to the extent where if you move the Iron Finals back into August by a couple of weeks, it actually screws us. We're here offering both sports equally, in the same way that Wexford do, and you know, plenty of other counties, but the big dual counties. And then people will say to me, well, yeah, that's fine for Galway and Cork, but like, what about everyone else? You know, like, we don't feel that same pressure. To which my answer, the more and more I've been talking to people about it, is like, well, you should be. You should be feeling that pressure, because you should be prioritising, or not prioritising, but, you know, bringing both of the sports along together. And the idea that Galway and Cork and Wexford and Tipperary and these counties should be punished for giving equal weighting to both. I mean, let's face it, Tipperary don't do that. But, you know, Galway and Cork and Wexford do try their very best to, and Dublin. They really do. Leash as well. Like, there are plenty of counties that give equal weight to both. Why should they be punished for counties that have decided, actually, do you know what? We're just going to focus on Gaelic football. And we'd love the idea of hurling. We'd love it for there to be 10 hurling clubs in the county, and we'd love to support it, but it can't be at the to the detriment of our Gaelic football team. And so that's what every GAA County Board says. You know, like, we would love to promote the weaker sport in our county, but we're not going to we're not going to skimp on the one that we're more interested in any way, shape or form, and therefore, you know, you're kind of screwed before you start, you know. So, and like, it's the same with Kilkenny. Like, Kilkenny should absolutely be mandated to promote football to the extent that, well, you know, whatever about to the extent that they promote hurling, they should do a better job of promoting football in their county. And like, that, in one way, that's totally revolutionary to how the GAA has developed, like, in a wide variety of counties. In another way, it's not revolutionary at all. Like, the idea was to promote Irish games and Irish culture in a sporting setting through the setting up of GAA clubs. That was the original idea. We haven't actually gone all that far away from that. That's still the idea. That's still the driving force, the motivating force. And these clubs are there, so we should make the playing of hurling as easy as possible for those clubs. And actually, the idea of if not punishing the clubs that don't do it, rewarding the clubs and the county units that do it, in a real sense. I've kind of gone round and round in my answer and round and round in my head for the 2 years I've been writing this book, but I do, that's at root, that's what I believe.
Would you go a step further and even just outside of the two main ones and extend that element to also like handball or rounders as well?
I don't think that. I think it's different, and I'll tell you why it's different. Because, like, the All-Ireland Hurling Championship is an incredibly well-attended, massive public interest sporting event. Handball and rounders aren't there yet, you know? So I understand the point that, you know, handball was set. Like, handball joined the GAA in the 1920s. You know, rounders is a different thing as well, you know? Do I absolutely think that in relation to ladies football and camogie? 100%. That's what we should be aiming for. This idea that if you're a J club, you've got four teams. You've got four adult, you know, senior teams, and you promote them all equally. Like, that's the idea. That's the idea behind integration. It's the idea that Michael Cusack had in 1884. It's the idea that hasn't changed since then. So whatever about kind of the handball and rounders is kind of I think it's a different thing. Maybe I'm talking out of the side of my mouth here, but like, I don't think so. I think that there is an infrastructure there for hurling. There is a desire there across the country in pockets, even in the counties that we don't think there's any hurling in. There are pockets there. We shouldn't make those people feel like they're intruders or they're outsiders in their own GAA club. And that does happen. Like, there's no point in denying it.
Yeah, it's interesting to bring up camogie and ladies Gaelic football, because I even think back to the fact now that Mayo won't have a senior camogie team, and the element that probably almost, just from a competition side, it's disappointing because then you've less competition in the West. But on top of that as well, it almost feels like you're taking away an element of Irish culture that was there.
Yeah, there just has to be a way for it to be allowed to thrive, you know, for so long there were excuses about the idea of women in GAA clubs, you know, that I finished national school in 1995. The idea that girls would have played Gaelic football in my national school, it just didn't happen. So why did that not happen? You know, you can say they didn't have an interest, you know, fine. Literally everything that's happened in the 30 years since then would suggest that that's just wrong. That the reality was that they didn't see any real way to play Gaelic football, and so they didn't. And the Ladies Gaelic Football Club in Milltown was set up, I think, 4 years later, and just immediately there was just an explosion of interest. It would be impossible and it would be ridiculous for me to sit here and say, oh, the explosion of interest only happened because the GAA club was set up, you know? Like, the interest was always there. The GAA club finally provided an outlet for that interest. So I think I think we all need to kind of think about that as well. Like, the idea that, it just wouldn't happen, you know, that the interest isn't there. You know, like, once we provided the infrastructure for women to take a fuller part in GAA clubs around the country, it happened everywhere. Like, everywhere. So, you know, we have that example to work off of if we want to sit down and say, right, actually, do we want hurling to be played in more places around the country?
talk to me. I want to go back to the book for a little bit because I wanted to ask a specific question on the audiobook format of it. Because obviously, I'm a big fan of authors who read their own books and put out the audiobooks. But there's an element to it that I always find that, particularly if it's your own words that you're reading out, you actually probably get a little bit more from listening to the audiobook than, say, you would actually reading the words on the page.
Yeah.
I know, obviously, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but the whole deal with yours is obviously it's very, like, you know, the humorous parts come across very witty and sarcastic. Do you think that there's a preferred format in which you'd like people to experience your work?
I've kind of been bowled over by how many people listen to the audiobook of the first one and subsequently of this one as well. And, you know, it's a fair old... it's a fair old ask to read whatever it is, like 65,000 words or whatever I ended up in the book. So it was like over the course of a number of days, like a bit of a struggle. But people do seem to really enjoy the audiobook. So, I mean, I am like a bibliophile, I have to say. Like, I grew up in a house full of books. My mom's a librarian. And I just love books. I love the idea of the physical book, holding the physical book. I mean, obviously the book is available on Kindle and all the rest as well. I mean, the idea of holding a book, just that's how I read, you know. And I like, if I'm going on holidays, I'll put a couple of books on a Kindle and I'll read that rather than lugging books around. But in the normal course of events, I would only ever read a physical book. And I've never gotten into the audiobook thing, I have to say, but... given the fact that people have, there's a certain level of familiarity with my voice if people listen to the Second Captain's podcast or the RT Radio 1 show that we do or have done for the last number of summers, then I suppose there's a certain familiarity there, and it's, you know, it's not much of a jump to then listen to the audiobook, I suppose. But certainly I worked hard enough and it broke my heart that many times that I'm very genuinely very happy that people are listening to the audiobook because recording it was nearly worse than writing the shagging thing, but it was great. And funny, even just from the point of view, the kind of a writing kind of thing, if there is another one, I actually intend recording the audiobook before I've finish my edits, because well, it's one thing reading and rereading and reading for the 80th time a chapter in the editing process, but actually vocalizing it and saying it out loud, like, you do catch yourself. If there's a cliche there, you're gonna, like, it's gonna hit you right between the eyeballs and it's actually gonna hurt you when you're like, oh, I could have done better. But there's, you know, that happens with authors in every book, I think, you know, that at some stage you actually just have to be like, there's this quote from a French poet, Valerie, that no poem is ever truly finished, only abandoned. And I think that's when you're writing a book, you do actually at some stage have to be like, the the actual analogy I'm stretching for is Father Ted and the car that he's about to raffle. You know, you see a dent in every sentence, and after a while, you just have to drop the spoon before you completely ruin the car. So, at some stage, you just have to say, for better or worse, here it is.
Brendan Barrington, you described him as an incredibly gifted, patient, brilliant editor. What was the best note he gave you while editing?
God, that's a very good question. He's an exceptionally gifted writer himself. He's the editor of the Dublin Review. And he's real, like, he has a very scholarly approach to these things. And genuinely, he just chops the fat off everything, you know, so every sentence. So now when I sit down to write my Irish Times column every Wednesday, it's not even... it's his voice that I'm hearing every time I read a sort of a flabby phrase. You know, I'm just like, what would Brendan do here? First of all, he would take 20% of the words out. And that's a great voice to hear in your head, you know. But really, the gift that Brendan has, and it was a massive gift in the writing of the first book as well, was that he's not a GA person. You know, he's a fan of the games, but he didn't grow up in a GA house or anything like it. He has a healthy kind of ignorance of, like, the minutiae of the GA that I kind of live with. And so he'll ask the obvious question. So whether that's, you know, in my first book I write about transferring from my home club to a club in Dublin, for instance, you know, and I would say stuff like, oh, obviously, of course, I've, you know, I felt guilty about that. And that's the thing that I would say and would feel intuitively, and any GA person that read the book wouldn't have need to have that explained to them. Mm-hmm. But then Brendan read it and said, why did you feel guilty? You've lived in Dublin for X number of years. You weren't going to go home training. Why on earth would you feel guilty about it? And so I would explain it to him, and then I would write that. And then the GA person that wouldn't need to have it explained to them why I felt guilty would then actually get an understanding of, okay, I'm actually a headbanger to have just automatically presumed that people should feel guilty about it, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's all these kind of sacred cows of the GA experience that I've written about in both books that actually don't make any sense to people who aren't from a GA background. So I think that was kind of his big gift to me, was just ask the obvious question, and that actually leads you in loads of very interesting, for me at least, tangents in your head and eventually on the page.
Mm-hmm. It's brilliant you brought that up, because you pretty much just stole the next question I had for you, which was about the fact that your book is so brilliantly accessible to people who know nothing about hurling, but at the same time can be enjoyed by people who have lived it their entire lives. Mm. Do you find, I suppose, as an author going into a book like this, and obviously with your background being so heavily involved in Gaelic games and people probably coming to you for real expert analysis on whether it be Gaelic football, probably maybe not so much hurling, but to an element because of your work, probably to that extent now. When you're writing a book like this, is there a part of you in the back of your head that's thinking like, oh, those people that are like looking for me for like unbelievable insight onto this, that and the other, like I need to kind of temper those expectations a little bit, but at the same time, I don't want to let them down.
Mm. I don't know who it was, what musician that said it. He was talking about the idea of, you know, kind of like that idea that you have to play to the first guy in the door and the last guy in the door. And so, you know, the biggest fan that you have, Springsteen or someone probably, but, you know, the biggest fan that you have, and then the person who's never heard your music before. Mm-hmm. And so you have to, I think that's not a bad guiding principle, you know, that you absolutely, the book should appeal to the hurling fan, but also explain it in ways, kind of as I kind of said in relation to Brendan and his work, that asking the obvious question in that scenario is good for the person who doesn't know a whole lot about it, but it's actually really helpful to the biggest GA person imaginable to actually sit down and think about these things that we just kind of take for granted. You know, is that weird actually, you know, that we hold it against someone if they don't travel from Dublin to Valencia Island or whatever to play for the local GA club down there to save that GA club from extinction or whatever. You know what I mean? Like all these things we just accept. It can be fun for the person who knows all that stuff intuitively, for it to actually be investigated and talked about and thought through on the page. So I don't look at it as kind of as the two things in opposition with each other. I think they actually complement each other, that you write for the broadest audience imaginable, and that there's plenty for everyone in that audience to pick and choose. And it is likewise, if there are phrases or if there are kind of GA situations that those people don't understand, then, you know, maybe there's a curiosity there that leads them in to walk into their GA club with their kid or whatever, and they learn it for themselves as a result of a phrase that they didn't understand or a situation that they didn't understand. So I kind of look at it as complementary rather than oppositional.
I wanted to ask, obviously, a huge part of this book, I suppose, even that I got out of it, and even your previous book, is kind of coming to terms with that you're getting older and you're kind of stepping away from the prime of sport, if that makes sense. And even, I suppose, it kind of comes up a little bit even in Second Captains when you're doing the promo for the National Lottery, by fitting your boots to whatever and going out and remaking your intercounty career. But do you, I suppose, is there an element of you that thinks about what life will be like when you can no longer physically play sport?
Honestly, I try not to think about it because it's still, like, I tried to tell someone recently that, oh, I think next year, and I was, I don't know, next year. And the person kind of, you know, like, she was looking at me going, I'm going to let you finish the sentence yourself before I tell you that there's no chance. And by the end of the sentence, I was like, well, I probably will play next year, let's be honest. And, you know, after that, who knows? But, you know, it'll come to December 2026 and I'll probably be wrestling with it again. Like, so I'm 43 now. And I did a bit of management this year, a bit of coaching this year, and really enjoyed it. But I also know for a fact I didn't enjoy it even 10% as much as playing it. And so there's a gang of us in my club in Dublin, which I'll return to next year. And I think we all kind of look at each other and go, well, we will retire, absolutely, but not right now. Because we're all just having too much fun. And we also like take it so seriously and care about it and get so much from it emotionally, as well as just having a lot of fun, which is what we do. I'll be on the golf course long enough, probably. Do you know what I mean? Being a bore around the clubhouse.
I suppose.
So I'm gonna keep playing for as long as I can, because honestly, team sport has given me so much. And you know, I grew up in a GAA house. I've only ever played GAA in a structured sense. I've never played any other sport. It's the same for soccer players, the same for rugby players. Play for as long as you can, because you won't be playing. You'll be long enough not playing. And everyone I talk to says the exact same thing. Just play until the body doesn't let you. So I picked up a few knocks this year, and my back isn't great, and fractured my wrist and all these things. But if I give it till the end of February next year, I'm hoping all these things will have cleared up. And yes, this idiot rides again, you know. I can't help myself.
You had the book launch in Shan Football.
Yeah.
Joe Canning was there. Yeah. Who was the most popular person in the room that night?
Tony Murphy, my dad by a country mile. I'm sure Joe won't mind my saying. Dad hadn't been down in a while. I was so glad that he was able to make it. And he has Parkinson's, so his movement is a little restricted and all the rest. But he had an absolutely brilliant night, meeting so many people that he grew up with. And obviously so many of my family were there as well. Tony Murphy won, Joe Canning two. The lads behind the bar in the Marine probably three. I definitely made top five. I would have made top five. But honestly, that night was such a special night, and I can't say enough about the people of Unshannable. Genuinely, like, the welcome they gave myself and my wife. I'm still wrestling with it, kind of at an emotional level, I think. They were just so warm and welcoming to us both for the last summer and this summer that we were down there. And the book obviously doesn't happen without that, but more than that, I mean, I just, the welcome they've given me was just I'll never forget it. I'll never be able to repay them. And actually, they do this for me, and their payment is that they'll never be able to get rid of me. So we'll be down there every summer probably for for as long as we can make it down the road. So the Marine was just kind of, it was a lovely summation of the feelings and the warmth and the welcome that we'd gotten for the kind of the 15 months before that. So that was a really, really special night, just Amdar Hale, really just absolutely gorgeous.
Any long term future plans to stay a bit longer?
I mean, about a month and a half in, we're basically decided we were moving down permanently, and then you know, real life intrudes. There's a plan, there's a dream, all right. But I think that you know, I'll spend a part of my of every year down here. I think that's fair enough to say. But how much of it depends on economic circumstances outside my control. But it's just such rural West Waterford is just unbeatable, genuinely unbeatable. And it would be a lovely dream for me to be down here even more often than I've been over the course of the last 2 years.
Obviously, you'd probably say being in Shanfo will, being able to launch the book and having everyone there was probably the biggest highlight of this experience. But I suppose being nominated for the On Post Book Awards must be a close second.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's a lovely thing. So I'm nominated in the Last Word Listener's Choice Award. And it's lovely. I had a hope that I might be in the sports section, but being in this one is kind of outside of my ken altogether, outside of my understanding altogether. It's such an honour to read so many brilliant books. And it just kind of emphasised in my own mind as well, that's kind of the point that you were making, that it's for the sports fan, but it's actually for people who want to know more about this corner of Irish culture and you know, the sort of the humour that's in the book, or that I tried to put into the book. It's lovely that it kind of has a broader audience than just kind of being put in the sports section of your local bookshop. So, yeah, it's massive. If there's a public vote element to it as well. So if you go on the unpostirishbookawards.ie, or is it just the irishbookawards.ie? If you Google Unpost Book Awards, it'll be there. I'm in category 9. So if you wanted to vote for it, if you like the book, go for it. There's a ton of other Waterford authors there as well, actually. So if you go on the Waterford Library's Instagram page, they have a voting guide. If you're a patriotic Waterford person and you want to support local authors, I'm sure they'd all appreciate your support, as indeed I do. So if the mood took you.
Finally, I'll finish by asking, throughout the book, there's copious amounts of times where you're asking journalists from the region, former Inchiquity players, people who are currently playing hurling, for words of wisdom that could benefit your own career going forward. What's one word of wisdom you'd give to someone who's starting out for the first time now that would have been in a similar situation to you at the beginning of the book?
About hurling.
Or in general.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're deciding to take up hurling in your early 40s, I would say, and I appreciate that may be a niche audience, but I would say manage your expectations. revise downward your expectations of how good or otherwise you might be. But I do also think that it was advice that a friend of mine, Claire Henderson, she's like a wonderful, one of Ireland's most gifted print artists. And I was telling her the plans for this, like right at the very start of this, so January 2024 or whatever, it's like that this idea had come into my head. And everyone else, so all of the rest of my friends were like, oh, you're mental, or, you know, how are you going to get used to living in West Waterford for 6 months or a year or whatever? And all Claire said to me was, I think it's brilliant that you're volunteering to be terrible at something in your 40s. And I think that that's probably a lesson we could all take on board, because I think we all maybe decide like at 23 or 24 or 25, okay, I know what I'm good at, or I know what I'm going to, what I enjoy doing, and just stick to that and do nothing else. And so the idea that you would volunteer to be terrible at something is actually, there's a lesson there, whether that's Irish, learning Irish, or whether that's hurling, or whether that's whatever the hell you like. The idea of curiosity, you know, to actually keep trying new things and volunteering to be awful at something and enjoying it anyway. I think that's maybe the life lesson to take from the whole thing. Or just spend loads of time in rural West Waterford. That's also a brilliant piece of advice. But anyway, I digress.
Absolutely. Ciarán Murphy, thanks so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks a million, Adrian. Thank you.